Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to invite you along to one of our worship services. We meet each Sunday at 10:30 a.m. Or if you happen to live in the Medway towns, the first Sunday of each month, we hold a divine service at the Evangelical Free Church on Widmore Road in Raynham, Kent. We meet, as I say, the first Sunday of each month at 3 o'clock. I also serve as vacancy pastor for St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride, Scotland. We meet on Sundays at 11 a.m. If you don't live anywhere near those locations, why not go to our website, lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory button and find the congregation that's closest to where you are. Go along, pay them a visit, and enjoy a worship service. I know that you will be received warmly. Again, I thank you for your prayerful and your financial support of Lutheran Radio UK. Without your prayers, without your generous contributions, we wouldn't be able to continue our internet radio programming. And we thank you for helping us reach around the world with the gospel and the love of Jesus Christ. Today, we are very pleased and excited to welcome with us Dr. Joel Bierman. He is professor of systematic theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Dr. Bierman's main interests are in Christian ethics and how the law applies in the life of a believer. He is also author of A Case for Character and Holy Citizens. We're going to be talking to Dr. Bierman about a paper that he recently delivered at the International Lutheran Council's World Seminaries Conference. So, Dr. Bierman, welcome to Lutheran Radio.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Now, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about the paper you delivered at the recent ILC World Seminaries Conference. I just love the name of your paper, No Longer Married, But Still Engaged. A very provocative title. Can you tell us maybe what you mean by that and what you're pointing to?
Yeah, well, I was given the task of discussing the situation of the church in the West, and the task I was given is my subtitle: the role of the church in the face of declining Christian influence. And so that was something of great interest to me. And so the way I approached it is thinking about the fact that for most of Western history, the church has played a key role, and the church has been quite joined to the state and to the wider culture in a way that I might say was like a marriage. So like a Constantinian sort of establishment is what's really was at work. And so you could liken that to the husband and wife, and they're married, they're working together in this sort of situation, and that's the way it was. Well, in the 20th century, and probably starting even in the 19th century, but really picking up steam in the 20th and happening more quickly in Europe and on the continent and now trickling also into the North American context, we see an increasing disengagement between the church and the state, or a division coming where the culture is less and less interested in what the church has to say, and the state really has very little interest at all. And so there's increasingly a space opening up where there's a separation and then perhaps even a divorce. And what I'm suggesting is that I think the point of divorce has come, where the church has now been essentially divorced by the rest of the culture and doesn't care. And yet my argument would be that the church, in spite of its being divorced by the culture and specifically the state, can't operate that way. We're still engaged with the culture around us. We still care about it. We still deal with it. And so, yeah, I'm playing on the idea of being engaged, as in we're part of the world and we have to be interacting with that world, and we have to be interacting not only with the culture, but also even with the state. And there are ways for the church to do that, and the church needs to do that. And yet we also have to face the fact that we're no longer sharing a life with the culture in the same way of sharing like a marriage bed with the culture, as we can maybe run the metaphor of how it used to be in the past. That time is gone.
You talk about how the church was married to the state, and you mentioned the word Constantinian, and you talk about that in your paper. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about what you mean by that, how that relates to the marriage, and how that works in the U.S.? I mean, in reading, I was struck how close the similarities are, although there still is some of this marriage, although it's a very weak marriage, I suspect, within Europe, much more so perhaps even than in America.
Yeah, it's what's interesting is you start getting into all the kinds of historical differences that go on between Europe and the U.S. and this sort of a thing. But the idea of Constantinianism is I think pretty well established. It shows up a lot in the literature that I deal with. And basically what is meant by Constantinianism is the alliance that was established between the church and the state. And I would extend it to the wider culture that became, in fact, the rule of the land during the reign of Constantine, the emperor, way back in the 4th century. So you begin in 313 with the Edict of Milan. And then within a decade, you've got the emperor already funding the Council of Nicaea and organizing and paying for that group gathering so that the church can get its problems straightened out and that the church can become the unifying factor of his new empire, of Constantine's newly gained empire. And so that becomes the beginning of what becomes known as Constantinianism, which is the church and the state working together to accomplish common goals, common purposes. And then you have the debate whether or not this is a good thing or a bad thing. And in the Eastern Church, they would see this is a good thing. They still celebrate a day for St. Constantine. And others are a little less sanguine about that. And there are people I have referenced referring the term Constantinianism, like Stanley Hauerwas and John Yoder and others, would actually identify Constantinianism as a great evil because they see this marriage of church and state as really compromising the church's distinct witness to the world, and the distinct way of following Christ becomes made a little less offensive, a little more palatable to the wider culture. And then by lopping off these hard offensive edges, we end up changing the faith. So that's where the idea of Constantinianism comes from. So the history is a long one. You see this traced all through Western history and culture, where you've got the rise of the full blast church is the state religion, and it kind of reaches maybe its beginning stages in Charlemagne, and then really just goes full blast all through the Middle Ages, where you have the church becoming a key player in the power games that get played by the political rulers of the day, and even the Pope even having his own armies and leading them into battle, kind of ideas. Wow, this is the antithesis of the church being church over against the state, but now just being one more part of the state. That's Constantinianism. Now, obviously, this would mean things like, well, a state-established church, well, that would be Constantinianism. And the reality is a lot of the countries in Europe still have a state church. But the other greater reality is that it doesn't play the role of influence or significance that it used to play. It's more of a figurehead sort of a thing. One might liken it to the enduring monarchy in your own country, where you've got a monarchy, but do they really have any political influence? And that's debatable at best, if there's any kind of real political power or influence. So that's kind of the role the church is playing. It's just diminished. Now, in America, we have a little different situation, because here we have no established church, there's no state religion, and yet religion still continues to be quite powerful as a force in the culture, but less so increasingly. And so it's not as powerful as it was when I was a child, and it's even less powerful than it was 10 years ago. It's definitely on the decline in its influence. And yet there's still a role for the church, a little more prominent than it is in Europe, which seems counterintuitive since we don't have a state church. But the church has always had a very privileged position in American culture and society, and has kind of enjoyed that and has made the most of that. And that's the whole idea of the Constantinianism coming unraveled. So while you might still have an official state church in a lot of countries in Europe, de facto, there's no church that's functioning with any kind of vibrance and doesn't make that much of an impact on the wider culture. And in America, we have never had a state established church, yet the privilege and the kind of significance the church has enjoyed for so long in the U.S. history, that's rapidly declining, much to the dismay of many Christians on the conservative side who want to try to recapture some of that influence. And then that's the debate now we're facing in our own culture is, what does the church do when we have this declining influence and where it feels like the Constantinianism establishment is coming unraveled? What do we do about that? I'll just point out one thing while I'm thinking about it. There are certainly vestiges of Constantinianism which are actually established in our own country as well. We might not have a state church, but we do have privileges given to the church by the state. For example, the tax-exempt status that the churches enjoy. No church in the U.S. has to pay property tax or sales tax. And pastors are also given a kind of a privileged position even in our American tax code, where a pastor is considered a self-employed person. He doesn't have to pay the same sort of taxes that others pay, but we make up for it in other places. So it's not that great a benefit. But there is still recognition from this side of the state that there's something different about the church that needs to be cared for. Those laws and privileges are being challenged increasingly, and I personally think it's only a matter of time before those are also eroded and then eventually gone, but they're still in place at the present.
In England, when you talk to people about America, they say, oh, it's a very religious society. I mean, in England, only about 6-7% of the people attend church on a Sunday morning. So when they talk about America, oh, everybody goes to church in America, but you point out that's really declining. Can you tell us a little bit about that and perhaps some of the reasons why?
Yeah, the polling is always interesting on this because, you know, being a churchgoer myself, I kind of just pay attention to that. I don't notice anything else. But the numbers are on the decline. There was a time when you had people who would go to church quite faithfully, and it was a key part of their ordinary lives. And it's not what it used to be. I think the numbers are down into like about 40% now will attend church regularly, which is still pretty high, but regularly means I think maybe once or twice a month. But those numbers are going down. Church attendance is less than it used to be. This polling also indicates that the rise of the nuns, those who would say they have no religious affiliation, is on the increase. So these things are shifting. They're not what they used to be. Why that is, I think, is simply that's a huge discussion. I mean, we could spend a long time on that. There are economic reasons. There are social reasons. There are theological reasons. I think the biggest factor is simply the creeping rise of secularism and sort of the Nietzschean idea of we are our own gods. We decide our own reality, determine our own truth. That has become the de facto faith of the West, and there is not a lot of room in there for theism of any kind, much less a Christian theism where you have Christ as Lord. These things are just being increasingly pushed to the side, and people don't think they have a need for this. The comforts we have in the West and the relative ease of life and security that we seem to enjoy also, I think, belies the greater reality of our own limited mortality and the fact that the world makes little sense apart from a divine being who's guiding and directing it. Those things are pushed to the side and kind of ignored, and everybody's busy accumulation of stuff and of a good life. And so I think all those factors conspire together to spell the increasing diminishing of the church or the lessening of the church's influence in the culture. I don't think we should be surprised by it. And it's not something that should be particularly catching anybody off guard.
And in your paper, you talk about something that's called MTD and its influence, or at least how people view religion today. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and maybe how that fits in with what you've just been describing, the secularism, individualism, that sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to get your hands around this. There's just so many factors at work, but it's helpful to see a few things that kind of stand out. And when you run across something that seems to describe really clearly what's going on, you sort of grab onto that. And that's what I think the work of this guy named Christian Smith has done. He's a sociologist at Notre Dame here in the U.S., and he has done extensive survey work among teens. And he has done this over a number of years and keeps on kind of adding on to this and working with this. And in his work, he came to realize that most teenagers in the U.S., even those who go to church regularly, are holding what he described as a new sort of religion, not necessarily new, but as a religion that has taken shape, which is not Christian and not Orthodox, but is actually quite prevalent even among those who claim to go to church on a regular basis. And that religion is what he dubbed moralistic therapeutic deism, or MTD. And he uses that term very carefully, the idea that it's moralistic, it's therapeutic, and it's a deistic religion. And I'll unpack that just a little bit. Moralistic meaning that there are rules for how you live and to guide and direct you. Therapeutic in the sense that the real goal and purpose of the religion is to make you feel better, to solve problems, to make things nicer and happier. That's the therapeutic aspect. And on that, He's drawing on the work of guys like Philip Reif and even Peter Berger, who see these are also sociologists who see this kind of impact coming from the rise of the therapeutic. The Mideism, he simply means the idea that there is absolutely a God who exists, but he pretty much stays out of our lives unless we need him. So then he comes up with what he calls the five tenets or the five key teachings of moralistic therapeutic deism. And I think these are worth considering a little bit because I think they describe so clearly what I see actually being the de facto faith of most of the Americans that I encounter, even those who are religious, I think are functioning with some degree of this MTD at work. So the first tenet is that God exists who created and orders the world, watches over human life on earth. So we exist, God, we believe in God. Oh yeah, absolutely. We believe in God. And in fact, the polling is still very high on this. 90% plus of Americans still believe in God. Second, God wants people to be good, nice, and fair to each other, as taught in the Bible and by most world religions. So there you have the moralistic part. We have a responsibility to be good to each other, be nice to each other, and that's what's expected, to be fair. Third tenet, the central goal of life is to be happy and to feel good about oneself. And now the therapeutic kicks in hard, that we're here, we're supposed to be happy. The purpose in life is to be happy. So then the goal of religion is to aid that process of learning to be happy and to feel good about oneself. Four, God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life, except when God is needed to resolve a problem. So there you have the deistic part. There's a God, he's powerful, he can do stuff, but he doesn't really get involved in our lives, he doesn't tell you what to do or what not to do, and he's basically just available for when you need help. So if there's some kind of crisis, then God will step in and help. If you need him to save your granny who's dying of cancer, you can pray and he will come in and help. And if you feel down, he might pick you up and make you feel, cheer you up, but he's not going to tell you not to sleep with your girlfriend. He's not going to tell you not to get drunk, because those things he doesn't care about. Then number five, good people go to heaven when they die. And obviously this fits the whole thing. If it's all about being moral and feeling good about things, if you're trying your best and you're good, you'll go to heaven when you die. And these are the five tenets of moralistic therapeutic deism. Now, there is no such thing as an MTD church that you can go join. And most people, if you would ask them, do you believe in MTD? They say no. But in fact, this becomes a lot of what people function with and how they operate. And the evidence of this, I think, is pretty widespread. And just the attitudes that people have, even church-going people, about other people, what's expected of them, the role God plays. And so you end up with a very comfortable, manageable religion that works for everybody. It really lubricates relationships, explains how people are to function, and makes life pleasant for everyone. It's a very good Western religion.
I'm very intrigued by that, because within the UK, when I talk to teenagers, I would say much of this is applicable, except for the fact, maybe number one, there is no God and there is no order. It's chaos. Survival of the fittest, if you want. But it's, we've got to be good to each other. We've got to treat nature well. We have to be tolerant of one another. And if there is a God, as you say, he's there to make us feel good about ourselves. And if there is life after death, it's only for those who are good. Is this seemingly prevalence of the denial of God, is that a huge part in America, or are you sort of lagging behind us on that one?
I think we're still lagging behind. Most people in the U.S., I would say, I'm doing a little bit from polling evidence and also from anecdotal experience. To be a flat-out atheist is still looked at askance in our culture. Nobody running for office is going to declare himself a flat-out atheist. That just isn't palatable yet in the American culture. We haven't gotten to that point. So we still want to hang on to the idea of a notion of a God and that responsibility. But God is a very beneficent, kind, grandfatherly sort of figure who's not going to mess around with things and certainly not judgmental about anything. And so that's what you get. And so that's kind of the situation here. Now, what I find fascinating also from my perspective, from an ethical standpoint, is the inconsistency in saying, it's, as you're describing, the teens you encounter, if it's all chaos, then why bother being moral? I mean, Nietzsche wins if that's the case. If there really is chaos, then it really is just a will to power. The problem is that leaves you with really morally objectionable realities that nobody wants to stomach. And so you end up trying to create new moral foundations, but nobody's been able to do that apart from an accountability beyond ourselves. And that's what Alistair MacIntyre so brilliantly lays out in on all of his work, especially in his you know kind of monumental book After Virtue. So that's the problem you've got there. So in the American context, we still have this idea of a divine being to whom there's some sense of accountability, which provides a little bit more of a rationale for morality. But the problem we're facing in our culture, as far as I'm concerned, as an Orthodox Christian or as a Lutheran, would be, well, where do you have any kind of actual content to what God expects? It just becomes this rather amorphous, be nice, do nice things, and it really doesn't amount to anything. So you end up getting on the outside just people trying to be nice to each other, just like in your culture as in ours, and whether God is part of that or not becomes sort of irrelevant, which is what leads to people like Stanley Hauerwas and others who make the claim that most people live as, even Christians live as practical atheists, because when it comes to real life, they don't act like God really matters much at all.
And I think that's the beat you move on to next in your paper, your normal nihilism, which I was fascinated by. Again, can you tell us a little bit about that and perhaps how what we've just been talking about leads to this idea of normal nihilism?
Yeah. So nihilism, nihilism, however you want to pronounce it, I hear it both ways. The idea is stemming from the Greek, the Latin word for nothing, nihil. So there's nothing. And often we hear this kind of idea of being a nihilist or nihilist, and we think of, you know, the kind of distant looking sort of 20-year-old who's reading Sartre and Camus, and since there's nothing that's real, nothing that matters, and he's just this kind of a bleak sort of all dressed in black, gothic sort of loving guy. But that's not really what we're getting at here. The idea of nihilism being sort of the normal way of operating is an idea that was really articulated well by a guy named James Edwards. And Edwards wrote a book called The Plain Sense of Things. And in that book, he makes this case for what he sees as a normal nihilism, which is pervasive in the culture today in the West. And he's thinking especially about the American context. And what he's arguing is, because we lack any sort of foundation that we're sure of, that becomes pervasive for the whole culture, foundation in God, or a foundation in moral truth, or in a foundation that's something that's outside of ourselves, we have now become the lords of our own lives and the gods of our own reality, which is the upshot of René Descartes all the way back in the 17th century, just all the way growing through the Enlightenment and reaching its pinnacle in Nietzsche, who declares there is no God, we're done with it, all that's left is myself and the interpretation I choose to bring to the world and the true reality I impose on the world. And so that's where you get the Nietzschean nihilists. And so then what Edwards is arguing is, this has not become an exception where you have a few weird people who are, I don't believe in anything, I'm a nihilist, but it's become the norm because we have no longer a foundation that we can all agree on as this is what is true. Now we have multiple truths. Everybody gets to decide for themselves. Everybody tries to figure out what's true for me, what's true for you, and we try to be compatible with all that. Well, in that situation, there is no way to talk about truths that are crossing people or crossing cultural gaps or crossing countries, much less. You now have everybody deciding for himself. And that foments the radical individualism, the fracturing of society, the kind of tribalism, and all the very things that we are decrying in our American context, and I think in other Western cultures as well, of the lack of unity and growing out of this kind of rampant individualism. All of that is growing out of this normal nihilism. And again, I think he's on the right track here, the sense that we are compelled to have to live as if there's nothing we can be sure of, and it's up to us to decide. And then what that does to a culture and how that erodes the bonds that hold a culture together.
And so this has significant impact on the Christian faith. If there is no such thing as truth, this obviously then impacts on how people view the Bible, how people view the church, how people view the proclamation of the gospel. Is that right?
Hugely, because now the Bible and the Christian way of life becomes just one more option. Edwards has just a compelling image. He says it's like the sprawling shopping center, or the, what we call a shopping mall here in the U.S., where you go to a building all under one roof, and you've got 150 shops all in one place, some huge department stores, other just small little shops. But every one of those shops is peddling something and offering a different way of thinking about things. And so you've got computer stores and sporting goods stores, and you've got bookstores and clothing stores. And outfitter stores for outdoors. And so he says that's very much how people look at the world today and the ideas and the things that are true. You have truth that is up to me. So I go shopping and decide what is true for me, whether I want to believe in the environment and I want to become a crusader for resisting climate change, or maybe I want to be a crusader for human rights, or maybe my thing is going to be seeking pleasure and I try to enhance my pleasures through sexual fulfillment or through becoming a wine connoisseur, or maybe becoming a marijuana expert, or maybe I see the real value in life is family, and so I focus on building strong family ties and have lots of family time, or maybe I do it through travel or through my love of soccer or football, as you would say, and I just become a fanatic about some team. Whatever it is, I find my value, my truth, my meaning in those things. Well, the problem is, it's just a choice I'm making. There's nothing definitive that anybody can say, no, this is the one truth. So Christianity is just thrown into that mix. It's just one more option. You like soccer? Great. I like church. You like church? Well, I'm an environmentalist. That's not my thing. And we treat it like it's just one more thing. The very notion that there is a God who created and who has truth for everyone, which is true across the board in all situations, is just absurd in the culture in which we're living. That's normal nihilism. And then Christians get sucked into that by thinking that, well, you know, each has his own choice. We all have our own options, instead of saying definitively, no, this is what's true for all people. And so even Christians fall into this trap of normal nihilism. And then they also become, even those who are faithful and orthodox, can become very quickly apologetic. You know, I wouldn't want to impose this on anybody, or I wouldn't want to, you know, insist that this is the way it is, when in fact that's precisely what we confess. This is the truth for all people. And so you have Christians who are increasingly unsure of themselves. This is a product of the normal nihilistic culture in which we live.
Dr. Bierman, I was just facing this the other night. I was talking to someone. I said, you Christians, you're so judgmental, telling me that this is wrong or saying your way is right. How can I better respond to that person? As you say, in our society, there is no such thing as right or wrong.
Yeah, the point of the nihilist argument and what we might call anti-foundationalism is that in fact we can't prove it. And see, Christians make the mistake sometimes in becoming apologists for the faith and thinking we're going to fight against this and we're going to prove the truth of the faith. That's not our game. We're not out to try to prove the faith. Jesus didn't try to prove anything, neither did St. Paul. He simply declared the reality. And so I think the best response we have is to say, well, let me tell you what I know, and let me tell you the truth that is, and just declare it. We don't need to be apologetic about it. We don't need to try to make a case for it. We just declare it and we make it known. And we challenge people to say, have you tried this? Have you experienced this? This is true. You need to see for yourself. And you invite them into tasting the Christian reality by actually imbibing it and being part of it.
Dr. Bierman, we thank you for helping us to grapple with what's going on in our world around us, particularly in the West. I'd like to invite you back next week as we carry on this conversation, and I'd like to invite our listeners back as well.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.